Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 322 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. There has to be a quicker way to say the numbers.
322?
That's not what you said, though. 322. Like, it was, like, the longest.
Drawn out. Yeah. Stop number shaming me. Shaming? Stop number pronunciation shaming me. You? Okay. This episode is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon. Help support content you believe in. To find out more, please visit outlanderpod.com/Patreon. And before we jump into the read-along, this week's co-producer is the lovely, also, I didn't say this last week, but also a Pod Abroad alumna, is the lovely Marlo R.
Yay, Marlo!
We miss you, Marlo! We want to see you again, Marlo!
And now, on to our read-along. You guys, I was just looking at my schedule, and we finish next week. We are going to finish Fiery Cross next week. What do you have to say to that, Ginger?
No, there's at least two more.
Nope.
Yes.
No.
Hold on.
I looked at it. We have this week's and next week's is 106 through 111.
No, next week is 102 through 105, and then the following week is...
Oh, okay. That's what happened. So I take that back. This is not the last week. But we only have two more read-alongs.
After this, that's
after this. So
wait, read-alongs or episodes for this
read-along? Read-along episodes for this one. The Fiery Cross, y'all. We are in the last like three chunks of the Fiery Cross. We are in the home stretch.
What is the longest book thus far out of eight?
Out of eight? Isn't it the next one?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you keep mentioning it.
Yeah.
This one honestly feels the longest.
This one might be for some people, might be the slowest.
I don't know anyone who's walked away from any of the other books. It took me probably a year to read this book.
Walked away. You walked away from number two for a little bit.
Well, I threw it against the wall and then I picked it back up because I was like, what? But this
one. You pushed it away from you.
This Fiery Cross, I started reading it in the summer when it came out and I set it down.
Oh,
and walked away for probably a few months before I was like, okay, now I need to start reading this again. Just because I was like, I could not get into it. I was so not interested in the gathering. And to be honest, I still am not interested in the gathering. And it's so long. Anywho, we are going to begin this week's read-along with chapter 98 entitled Clever Lad.
Roger is up, but Bree and Gem are asleep. He is transcribing song lyrics as... A burst of wind undoes one of the corners of oilcloth over the window. Now, the current song he's working on transcribing is a reeving ballad. Maybe it's a reeving. I think I spelled that wrong. Anyway, I looked it up. It's a term, probably a Scots term, for raid, like, you know, cattle raid, whatever raid. It has a lot of verses. It had many variations also, of which Roger knew three.
But he had gotten a new one. He learned a new one from Kimmy Clellan. Clellan was a man who'd sing for his own pleasure or for that of others. So he was, sounds like me.
Own pleasure, not for the pleasure of others.
Look, yes, I've gotten plenty of compliments. Shut your mouth. Anyway, but yes, definitely for my own pleasure or my own earballs. I don't know. Then Diana writes, quote, the rest of the company at the big house, ... unquote. So there was company? Like, did I skip a chapter? Did they have like, where are these visitors from? What did I miss, Summer?
I don't think you missed anything, Ginger. I think this is just life on the ridge.
Because,
you know, as people pass through, as they are wont to do, they, you know, hello the house.
The ridge is out of their way. Come on. You got to go.
It could be, but if it's not, what if it's literally in the direction of the place they're trying to go? And this is the only stop between them and, you know, destination. I don't think you missed anything. The only newcomers in the last chapter were the Christies.
That's true. And the Outriders. Don't forget
the Outriders. But there's constantly like it. I feel like this in this book, the ridge is in flux.
Yes. Okay. So maybe we didn't miss anything. The candle that he's working by goes out. Bree wakes up, then goes back to sleep. Then Jenny wakes up. Bree grabs him.
And then everyone's awake.
And everyone's awake because we find out real quick that Jemmy is
potty training.
Thank you. I couldn't think of the word.
Clever training.
Clever. Oh, that's funny. So Bree's like, as soon as she hears him, she's like, oh, we're doing this. And she wakes up. She's like,
I'm not
Roger,
kidding.
Roger, let's go.
There are very few noises in life that will pull you from a dead sleep. One is a crying baby, but also one is a cat trying to vomit. Like, there is no noise that wakes you up faster than the sound of a potential vomiting animal.
Oh my gosh.
Anytime. Because yes. I feel like cats make a big deal out of it.
You mean they're dramatic?
Have you ever seen a cat with a hairball? And I'm not saying that it's not.
Who are you talking to here?
Just cats. Yes, of course. But I'm just saying, if you've seen a cat, it's like they're so dramatic about throwing up because they're like they heave for like. And half the time, like my cat, I don't think I've ever seen. He's never actually vomited. He's never actually had a hairball, but he sure acts like he's going to, which is worse because it's like hairball interruptus. Like, I keep thinking, this is it. He's going to, like, you know, and you're staring at it like, don't vomit. And then he stops and you're like, wait, you didn't vomit? What was all that for? All that wind up for nothing.
Stop vomit shaming kitties. So he makes the noise or he wakes up and Bree's like, we're not going to miss this opportunity. So she basically strips him down and tells Roger to find the chamber pot. So the candle's gone out. It's really dark. He's on his knees searching in the dark for the chamber pot. He's still going over the lyrics in his mind so as not to forget them. Quote, Willie was stricken over the head and through the kneecap, knobskull, unquote. He finds the pot and they put Jimmy on the pot. So Bree tends to Jem as Roger looks for the candle. He finds it, and luckily it didn't break. He relights it, and they have a chat about the phrase, to go potty. Now, listeners, this may seem an odd request, but since we have listeners all over the world and in different parts of the U.S. even, that was very interesting intonation for me, all over the, like, what state or, like, if it's California, you know, northern, central, southern, whatever, same with Texas, same with Alaska, whatever. I want to hear from you guys. What is a phrase that is used? Summer, you and I, to go potty sounds like just perfectly normal to us, right?
Yes, but then when I lived in the South, a lot of people said, I got to go TT. So every time you say TT, I'm like, we're not talking about urine right now.
Correct. That is, I never do. I mean, I never
German's
call it
that. German's my favorite, yes. Though. Because they make pee-pee.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't make already or, made. Like,
to make or, machen means to make or to do, but yes. So yeah, listeners, let us know, like, what is either in your native language or in a language you speak or a term that you're aware of, even if it's not your language or your country. But definitely let us know your native phrase or a phrase that you've heard and its source for to go potty. Because here's two people both speak English and it's completely different and it's hysterical. Meanwhile, go potty was quickly replacing the lyrics in Roger's mind. Roger's suggestion? Do a poo.
I mean, it's the most succinct.
And this wakes Jem up. Of course it does, because it's about a body function.
And who doesn't love saying poo?
Poop. Poop is actually funner. Poop. Well, funner. Oh my God, funner. More fun.
Poop feels like a finished thing. Poo is unfinished. Poop means you put a P on the end of it and it's done.
But I'm getting a lot of plosives here, people.
Poo is kind of open-ended. You know what I mean? Poo.
With encouragement, he does a poo. When he reflexively says to Jem, this is Roger, clever lad. It seemed not to be in his normal voice. Well, they all go back to bed, and just on the edge of sleep, Roger remembers clever lad was something his mother had said, as in, do you need to be clever? Do you need to go to the bathroom? Do you need to be clever? So from now on, Summer, potty breaks are clever breaks. And that's the title of this episode.
No.
Yes.
You know what?
Clever breaks.
I hate it when you announce titles of episodes during the and first never chapter.
Okay.
There are four whole chapters, and I may say something incredibly clever over the next hour.
You may say something incredibly clever, or I may laugh at something and think of something else. But at this point, it's clever break. Now, in my notes, I don't think I found anything better. But you're right. You're the unknown quantity here. So we shall see. And me sometimes too. So at this point, I like clever break. Clever breaks. Bree's response to this, well, it's better than poo. Can't talk either. Bree's worried that if she died right then at that moment, that Jem wouldn't remember her. This, of course, comes from Roger's pretty much. He opens up his mind in this chapter and remembers a little bit more of his mother. But in general, he doesn't have a lot of memories of his mother. And so this has made her worry. So Roger assures her that Jem would remember them both by their object, if not just memories of them themselves, but also by their objects and their meaning. And Roger thinks to himself, especially if he read your dream journal.
Good
read
Lord.
Your dream journal.
He used to burn that.
He also mentions his looks. She is identifiably Fraser's daughter, and Jem is identifiably her
Fraser's
son.
Grandson.
Yes. And he's all in tomatoes. Not that he likes them or doesn't like them, but he'll remember that liking tomatoes was something that Claire and Brianna, I believe, had in common.
Oh my God. I'm so glad they didn't cast me as either of those characters. I couldn't do it.
They chat about knowing someone and how hearing about them beforehand kind of merges with your image of them, whereas hearing about them after you know them can affect how you see them still. And I think eventually, in both cases, both merge. But if you already know someone, it's odd to have your firsthand experience and knowledge of that person. Experience of that person shift. I think that's a little more uncomfortable than having an idea of someone and then seeing them in the flesh, getting to know them, and have the two kind of even out and meld. One's a little more potentially jarring because it's much more personal. It's challenging a personal experience rather than simply something that you were told or something that you had in mind that you imagined. We learned that Roger's mom had died in the Blitz in London, or it's repeated. But we do learn more about
about
what happened. So he'd gone with his mom down to London to live with his grandma, a widow, after his father was killed in the war. And I wrote in parentheses, "Enter a leaf on the wind of All Hallows." I think all of the bulges. I don't mean required as in you have to listen to ever join us on the show. Absolutely not. But I think whereas Lord John books are fun and I like them, they're not required reading for the main Outlander series as far as knowing what's going on or even getting a lot of extra information. However, I would suggest The Scottish Prisoner. However, The Bulges, I really, really recommend that you read them, especially A Leaf on the Wind of All Hallows. So Roger is going down Picto memory lane. He's going through his memories and sharing all these images he had. So he suggests to
Brianna that she do a self-portrait next time they're in at River Run.
Okay, let's say you are going to do a self-portrait.
I wouldn't, but okay.
What do you think it would look like?
Of me?
Yeah.
What a rude question.
No. Because here's the thing. I can't really draw. I don't draw at all, and I barely paint, and I can't paint people, and I'm just imagining how awful my quote-unquote self-portrait would be. It would be Picasso. It would be, like, worse than Picasso.
Oh, my.
And Picasso's famous for stuff that doesn't look like anything.
Roger realizes that he does actually remember more of his mother than he thought he had, and he tells Brianna. He says about her passing, basically. He was with her when the bomb dropped. He remembers. There had been a siren. They had gone to the nearest shelter. And for them, that was across a tube station across the street. He describes the mass of people going down the stairs and the hit of the bomb, the landing of the bomb. The tunnel, the upper part, I think the upstairs, had collapsed, but he'd been rescued. He had this image in his mind of, she let go of my hand, she let go of my hand. But then as he kind of relaxes into that and allows himself to open up to that memory, he realizes, she didn't let go of my hand and leave me. She let go of my hand and then picked me up.
Yeah, threw me.
And threw me over the wall.
Threw me over. But now here's the thing. Here's my question. Mm-hmm. Is it threw me over the wall of people?
Oh, no. It was a wall down wall. To the lower level. Yeah.
A wall to the lower level?
Like over the, like a banister or something, but it was a wall.
Like a rail.
I don't think it was a rail. It was, because it was a solid, some kind of solid wall. She was either on the stairs. I think she was still on the stairs with everybody.
Oh, yeah. She died on the stairs. She didn't make out.
So he could, quote, he could see his mother's face shining clear among the stars. Clever lad, she said. And smiled, unquote. So the end of that, it was a very good chapter. I know we're laughing and kind of slightly making light of different things that, you know, of things we normally make fun of. But that chapter, Diana, the end of it was very Diana, definitely had a little bit more than a tear prick there.
A little bit of a Sophie's Choice moment. Not that she had to choose between two. I'm not going to give away the end of Sophie's Choice. What's wrong with me? It's not the same choice, but it's an impossible choice that has to be made. And I hope that if I were in a similar situation, that I would be able to make the same choice.
Are you getting teary?
No, I'm drinking tea.
Should have lied and said, yes, I'm sorry. Give me a moment. I'm just kidding.
I'm just saying. I think that's a beautiful thing. I like to think that all mothers are born with that, but they aren't. I'm not saying I'm not. I hope I am. I hope I never have to know that I'm not. I hope I never have to find out I am. But that's heavy, man. And now on to chapter 99, entitled Brother, in which I'm kind of mad at Jenny again, but for a whole new reason.
We are back to Claire's POV. The chapter begins on a cusp. Claire is despairing and appreciating the thaw of winter and the beginning of spring. Losing their shield from the world outside and the promise of spring and planting and new life. Jamie was ready to sell his stuff. To cut to the chase, he needs a good smuggler. He wants to kind of, they need money. He wants money for it. He doesn't want to give it away, but he needs someone to help him.
That's not what I took at all. That's not how I took this at all. This is all the plan. He doesn't really need to sell. The selling isn't about the selling. This is all about the setup to get Stephen Bonnet.
Absolutely. But he was not ready before now. And his in is not the setup. He needs to be ready to part with whiskey. When he spoke with Lyons at the beginning, I think it was at River Run, he was not ready to part with whiskey. He is now ready. Yeah, I'm not saying the impetus of all of this is to make more money.
Okay, I'm just making sure you're not. Because I was like, that's not the point at all. Okay.
He's ready to part with his stuff for the purpose that he had the purpose in mind for a long time. So to cut to the chase, he needs a good smuggler. The crux is he wants to find Bonnet. But you back up 7 or 3 or 20 steps, choose a number. And the way he's worked out, the best way he's worked out to be able to get to Bonnet, not legally, but with the least amount of maybe...
eyebrows being raised, as not to the law, but as far as Bonnet goes, right? He needs to have someone who Bonnet already works with or already knows or already trusts work, at least if not directly with him, then down the line from him. So he needs to set up some legitimate, quote unquote, something that can be smuggled. And since there was already that little, you know, chat about the whiskey, and he's like, nah, but it's been maybe not a year, but it's been a bit now. And so he's ready to start this chain, basically, this chain of decisions.
Now, do you think that he's keeping it anonymous on his end, that he's the purveyor? Because I don't think he can say his name. If he says, because Bonnet knows their names.
I would think he's not really advertising the fact that that's him.
Okay, because that would ruin the whole thing, I would think.
Jamie had been assured that, quote, Stephen Bonnet was by far the most able in such endeavors, unquote, meaning smuggling. And so he's all, please arrange a meeting, thanks. So all this to say, he sent a letter to Lyon, letting him know he was ready to start this whole thing. I'm ready to give up some whiskey, ready to you know, divulge myself of some whiskey. And I need a good smuggler for this, since it's obviously illegal. And I've heard that Stephen Bonnet is the one we should go with. Can you help me out? Can you arrange a meeting? And so he's waiting on the connection, right? Waiting on this letter from Lyons. It has not come. But there was one from Jenny. It had been written September 16th, 1771. So I believe this is the next year. So remember, it's on the cusp of spring. We don't get the exact date here, but I'm guessing March-ish. So it was from the previous fall. She's writing to forgive him and let him know what she observed. Well,
but
partially,
not really.
Not all the way at Balbriggan. Or let him know that she had observed something at Balbriggan, but not giving them the whole story.
But what drives me crazy about that is that was her whole impetus for telling him. And then she didn't finish the story, and we all want to know.
Yeah, it was not nice.
Or maybe that was her whole thing. Like, she's like, see, I haven't forgiven you. I'm going to leave you wondering, and you're just going to sit there and fester in it.
So how did Jenny come up on, or she does not like to go hang with Leary? How did she come to be around her or close to her at all?
I know the answer. Well, are you actually asking me? Are you going to ask me something I know the answer to for once? No?
No.
Okay, fine.
She'd been out visiting her daughter, who had given birth to a child.
I should hope so.
Yeah. And her mule had taken a fall. And she was returning from her visit to her daughter. Her mule had taken a fall and she fell off as well. And she injured her foot. The only place nearby was Balbriggan. So she's walking to the house. I gotta tell you, I learned so many words when they speak or write Scots. So many. So the one Claire asks about, as Jamie's reading this, and Claire's like, what does this mean? The one Claire asks about, as opposed to a smizzle of rain, spavined or spavined snail, gromished from the fall. I don't even look those up. Like, those are three very good words to learn. I don't know what they are. She asks about Hawk McGandy. Which Jamie tells her is fornification.
Did you just say fornification?
I did.
Is that the word? Isn't it just fornication?
No, it's fornification.
What's fornification? What's the extra F for?
It's fornication.
Thank you. I was like, why are you putting an extra F in there? You're an idiot.
And someone's... What?
I was like, fornification? There's no extra pho. What is that for? I'm like, I've never heard it said that way ever.
No, but there's fornification.
No, there's fortification.
No, fornification. Come on.
No, is that like a special kind of vacation?
No, I didn't say vacation.
I know, but Cation.
And someone says, I think it's, I don't know. I wrote it in parentheses here because I certainly didn't know it. In parentheses, shedding her shanks.
As you do. Shed your shanks.
So apparently shed that's her synonym. Stop it. She realizes through, this is Jenny. She realizes through being upset on his behalf that she must not have lost all feelings for him after all. The letter stops there.
Continue 2 days later, September 8, 1771. She goes on to talk about young Ian.
And say nothing about Larry.
And no mention of the Hawk McGandy.
Like, we wouldn't have even cared if she hadn't started the story. Like, exactly. We only wanted them to be, you know, close family again. But then she got us all hopped up and excited about her gossip that she immediately decided to not tell us anymore.
Correct. I mean, yes. She comes around to tell him, if the loss of Ian haunts my dreams, the loss of you haunts my days, Jamie. She remembers the time Jamie had been punished for lying and telling her dad that he'd broken a ceramic jug when Jenny had actually done it. And she says that she had felt the blow of each stroke of the whip when he was punished the second time for lying. She ends with, quote, "Mother loved you always, Jamie, and when she kent she was dying, she called for me and bade me care for you as though I could ever stop," unquote. Jamie feels much better after the letter. I have a question for you, Summer, because we haven't heard anything, but we don't normally hear things at this point anyway. I don't want to lose all hope. First of all, we don't necessarily need Jenny in season 5. We don't need her. We can have him reading a letter, okay?
Fine. Yeah.
If this letter is even there, I don't even know. I'm not going to speculate. But do you think we've lost Laura Donnelly forever?
I don't know. She was doing theater
for a while.
So I don't know if she's taken if she takes a break from that and clears up her schedule
and
some more.
Is available.
Yeah. And I mean, they haven't been offering. I mean, Jenny's been kind of sidebarred. She's not very big. So I think that as future books come, I think they could possibly entice her back. But we'll see. She might be like, man, I'm done. But I can't imagine her being like that. I do know that we've got some continuity issues with this chapter.
Wait.
Some show continuity issues.
Don't get ahead of me.
I'm not going to get ahead of you.
I have a thing or
you just,
40
I feel like
to say
you just
want to
say it first, but whatever.
No, I just want to wait till we get there because I'm quoting the line. So yeah, I do want to say that, but wait, we're not there yet. Okay. Jamie feels much better after that letter. Contributor Joe B. So good to have you back, Joe. Always love all of you guys when you give us your comments. We'd love to include them. Joe B. writes, with plots afoot for Wiley and Bonnet, Claire dreads the mail. She's waiting for the piano to drop. And into this stress comes the long-awaited letter from Jenny.
I was like, wait, did she order a piano? I don't remember that.
Claire may not support Jamie's plan for revenge, but she will support and protect him from what she can, even from his sister. But she can't do it. Her fear overridden by curiosity. While pleased that she won't open it, you know, open the letter and like get rid of it and protect him from something that whatever, she couldn't do it. She was able to stop herself and wait for Jamie to come home and open it himself. Joe continues, while pleased that she has forgiven / absolved Jamie for his part in her son going to live with a Mohawk, if only because he feels he needs it, and as if he could have stopped him. Mm-hmm. She allows that as Ian is now a man, he has the right to his choices, and it is not the part of women to question that. She certainly doesn't give any latitude to Leary, who was the catalyst for this letter. Jenny has little right to the moral high ground she is claiming. The need for alimony wouldn't be there if she hadn't pressed him to marry in the first place.
Well, let's be honest. It goes even deeper than that. I mean, it's not just that she pressed him. I'm like, the need for alimony wouldn't have been necessary if she hadn't pressed him, yes. But the whole reason that they're on this continent is because they had to go get Ian. And because Ian got picked up by those, what are they, smugglers? Not smugglers, the pirates or whatever. The privateers or that boat that pulled him out of the water when he went out to go get those stones because they were trying to pay Leary. If you look back hard enough, none of those things would have been turned into motion if she hadn't talked Jamie into marrying her. So this is all her fault.
I wonder, Joby continued, I wonder how much of Jenny's outrage is transferred guilt. She can be angry at Leary when she can't or won't be angry at herself. That's a very good point. Continued, at this point, we don't know anything more than what Jenny has observed, and how quickly does she jump to thinking the worst? And the part of me that thinks Jenny deserves to feel bad for her reaction to Jamie is begrudgingly giving Leary some props. So she's, quote, living like a lord. Well, you all agreed to such a large sum, and so she's getting some loving. It's probably the first time in her life that she can have her cake and eat it.
I don't know. She got her cake and didn't want it.
I think she found out Jamie wasn't her cake.
I'm just saying. That was her cake for how long? And then she got her cake and didn't want to eat it anymore. I would never turn that cake out of my bed.
Jamie and Claire go out to castrate pigs and clip their teeth.
Why you gotta make it sound so interesting?
Come on, that is not my NPR sex voice. Stop it.
But it was exciting. You were like, nah, they're going to go and castrate pigs.
They discuss the value of castration of men. Claire thinks on Jamie's marriage to Leary, and she's still thinking on that portion of the letter from Jenny. I mean, come on, they both are. Joe B. writes, how I love Jamie and Claire discussing Leary whilst castrating pigs. A classic Diana Gabaldon method of having characters do something while talking about grave matters. Jenny sees what Leary is doing, as it were, as emasculating her brother. And I think ultimately she is right. Their marriage failed in part because Jamie couldn't be the man he thought he should be, and couldn't be the version of himself that Leary thought she finally had. No one wants to spend much time thinking of Jamie and Leary in bed, and clearly it was unsatisfactory to both of them. Another reason, ethics, morality, and money aside, I'm glad that after three unhappy marriages, she's potentially found someone with whom she might be happy.
The only way to stay happy is to never, ever marry him. I mean that. Because
and
she will
getting
lose
the money.
She'll lose all of her freedom.
That's true. I see what you're saying. Fergus and Marsali are visiting with their kiddos. And now we know, at least for what their house is full. Some of them are speaking French. Others are talking about childbirth. Germain asks Jamie about his bowels. Lots of talk of bowels. They talk of loving each other by candlelight. Okay, wow. Talk of bowels. So that's like not quite a... Maybe somewhat of a pastoral lallybroch scene, you know, everyone there in the living room or whatever it was, the living area with
more
candles and playing games and all these things. And then later that night, Jamie and Claire are in bed, going to bed, and she's brushing her hair, and they talk of loving each other by candlelight, meaning loving the way they look, the other looks by candlelight. And then what does he do, Summer?
I mean, that's not the lead in to it. I mean, are we talking about the thing I texted you about?
Yep.
You want me to say it? Are you going to beep it?
Of course I will. Only halfway.
The titty fucking scene?
Yep. I wonder if they'll bring us that.
I'm positive they won't. And this is the first time in five books, where I can absolutely without a doubt say this is not going to be in the series. It's no Spartacus.
So they do. Oh, well, even Spartacus didn't show us that.
Yes, but they had lots of other things.
Oh, well, it was stars. So they do that. What does she do as he does that?
Greases it.
What is it?
Her boobs. What are you talking about?
What? She does it for him when he does his thing. But then she reaches around the corner and plays.
I'm going to need you to finish that. I'm going to need you to finish that statement because clearly I missed it. What?
Prostate pirate.
I did not say that.
Not you.
I thought you said you just said it. I was like, I didn't say that.
No, you said the part you said is what he did.
Okay.
And then she does something. What was that thing?
I didn't get that at
all. The prostate tickle. You didn't get that?
I missed that part. Apparently I, you know, blinked.
Well, you missed a paragraph or two last week, so it doesn't surprise me. It was inferred, but it was pretty certain. Are you looking for it now?
No.
Oh, well, you're coming away from the mic like you normally do when you're looking for something.
No.
So after that, they sleep. And when she wakes later, he does what, Summer? And this is what I forget I did. So he does the thing. She does the reach around. They go to sleep. Oh, sorry. Hello. And they sleep. And when she's awake, when she wakes up later, what is he doing?
Sleeping her.
Yeah, ish. And she's not very happy, understandably. And he wakes, she like yells at her.
But the thing is I think that if he were treating her the way he normally treats her, she wouldn't have been upset about it. But the fact is that he was treating her like not like her. And it was like, and that she, what did she scream out? Who exactly were you having sex with?
So she's not happy. He's wakened out of his dream. He's like, holy crap. He grabs clothes and pieces out. And she goes out after him. The only way that he can work off his frustration, his being upset at himself, his everything, his embarrassment, his shame, whatever it is he goes like, he needs to go work up a sweat. And after reading that he was there working with a pitchfork and straw, or sorry, hay, like, hey, it's Jamie in the hay again. He tells her, they have a chat, like, you know, not touching. She does go grab his hand later on, but they chat about this. And he tells her he loves her more than anything, but he doesn't understand why he's jealous of the man who was doing the Hofmagandy with Larry. Claire stays calm and patient while Jamie works this all out. So he's kind of, I wouldn't necessarily say he's a verbal processor. Like if you would have said, name, what kind of processor is Jamie? I wouldn't have said necessarily a verbal processor. But right here, he is maybe not completely verbal processing, but he's definitely processing like, what's going on? What is wrong with me? Why am I feeling this way? And Claire's there a number of times. Diana mentions she just like keeps her mouth shut. So she's literally there to support him as a sounding board, to support him, period. Also as a sounding board, period. And just there to hold space for him while he works this out. But he doesn't understand. Is he having feelings of inadequacy? And here comes, okay, I think what Summer was getting at. Here comes the chat. I will say it. Yes, I will say it. And you can be upset with me, dear listener. Or sorry, hopefully not upset. You can disagree with me. But this is a chat that the show messed up. They got this wrong, period. Okay, Summer, what were we going to talk about?
Well, the thing is the show made a choice. They made a choice to make Jamie aware. And Jamie being aware of Leary being the one who tried to kill Claire by sending her to Gayla Sunken, making him aware of that, and then still marrying her years later, was completely out of character, and even went so far in the book.
You said the word.
Saying, if I'd known that, you can't believe I would have married her. Like, you couldn't get more starkly different between show Jamie and book Jamie.
So Jamie is working things out, as I said, and Claire...
I thought Claire worked it out earlier.
No, Jamie's working... Sorry, stop it. Jamie's working things out verbally. And Claire pipes in, quote, I think it was her, not you. Though, of course, I may be prejudiced. She did try to kill me after all, unquote. She fills him in. He says, Christ, Cessnack, you canna think I would have married the woman knowing she'd done such a thing to you, unquote.
Except he did.
This is an example of getting it. And I'm going to go back to Summer already said it. Summer's not as intense about this as I am, but she used the exact same word and she's proven my point for me. This is an example of getting it very, very wrong. Very wrong. This changed Jamie's character. This changes his character. His character. We're not talking about events happening or not happening. We're not talking about leaving a scene out. Right? We're talking about making it. Summer's right. It was a choice. In my mind, it was the wrong choice. And this is not because I'm a book purist. No, I believe I do. And I love the show.
It's a butterfly effect that came almost instantly to roost.
Well, and yes, and people who know the books watch that show, watch that scene, and were like, I mean, literally, you could hear the exhale, sorry, the inhale around the country, whatever.
It's like, you exhale like that?
No, that's a pretty strong exhale. That would be hard. I mean, I can't. So this changed Jamie's character, right? So the right. other, this is different.
Well,
this
the exact is, opposite well, of what happened, meaning
I know.
He did marry her knowing she did that, which we all went, huh? And then in the book, he very clearly said he would not have been able to do that if he'd known.
Yes. So the difference of something like this. Okay, another time, and there may be more, but the two that stand out in my mind. So this was probably the first time they did something that was just inherently false for Jamie's character, right? Inherently false. This is not saying you can disagree. As if you're a book reader and you know about Jamie's character, blah 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 blah. You can say yes. In the books, he is a profoundly religious man. The show chose not to depict him as such. Yeah, I do think you lose things of his character, but not choosing to, they're not denying the fact that he's Catholic. No one's saying that, but they're definitely not making it an important part of his life, at least not showing us that. But you know what? That's a choice that doesn't affect necessarily the rest of the workings of the show, right? His interaction with other people. He's still Jamie Fraser, King of Men, blah, blah, blah. That's just a choice of what they chose to not to portray. This choice was changing his character. He willingly married someone, the one, a woman who tried to have the love of his life, the mother of his children, killed willingly.
The future mother of his children.
No, I'm talking about in the book, by the time he marries Larry, the babies are born. Claire's gone.
Yes, but he didn't know then.
What I'm trying to say is, in the book, he didn't know. In the show, when he said yes to Leary, not when he found out about Leary trying to have her killed or send her to Cranesmere, when he married her, book or show, it was past the point that they had faith and lost her and that he sent a pregnant Claire through the stones. So by the time he married Leary, in either production, in either thing, he had two kids by his love of his life. And to know that someone would have tried to kill her, that's just right here. It's in Diana's own words. You can't think I would have married the woman knowing she'd done such a thing to you. That right there is a big like, okay, it was a choice, whatever. So that's a very strong fit. The only other one that I can think of off the top of my head that was also maybe not this bad, but definitely out of character for changing Jamie's character, which was like a big WTF, was I think in Voyager, I don't remember which episode, when Jamie was locked up, or even before he got locked up, when Jamie was trying to force and threaten Fergus to attack people to do mutiny. That was, I mean, I watched it. Yes, I love the show. But I was just like, what? Like, it was not him. It was not him. So anyway, it happened more than once. That one probably is less, that's just, that was the thing that they added, which is different. It may not be in character for him, but at least it was a thing, a new thing that you can say you like or you didn't like, right? What they did with the Leary conversation was not an added, it was a change. So there is a difference there. But anyway, I digress a little bit. So they make up. He kind of works through a little bit. They make up, and he asks, you know, do you ever think of Frank when, you know, does he ever come to your mind, you know, even unbidden when we're making love? And she's like, there's only room for two of us, and I don't want, you know, spirits come and whatever, blah, blah, blah. She had a very nice and poetic way of answering without saying yes or no. Or I should say without saying no. Jopie closes us out on this chapter with Jamie's subconscious / dreaming sex is part of the claiming back of what is his possession as a form of dominance, a tactic both he and Claire have used separately and together. I am sure Freud would have a lot to say about this. Claire finally reveals the witch trial narrative, and this goes some way to absolve the quandary of emotions Jamie has toward Leary. Knowing her part in it, he can add to his forgiveness of himself for his own sense of betrayal of Claire. Her silent admission that Frank is still about means they can put ghosts in their place
and leads Jamie and Claire back to each other.
And that was chapter 99. Moving right along to chapter 100, entitled Dead Whale, which we don't even see till the next chapter. So I think that it's weird that they talk as much about it in this one.
It's March 1772. Still no word from Lion. So they decide they, along with Bree, Roger, and Marsali, and of course all the kids, would go to Wilmington, while Fergus took Roger's survey reports to New Bern. They'd stock up on supplies. Now, do you remember, the survey reports. That was what Roger, before the fire, Roger was sent out with the astrolabe to survey the land, right? Remember that? Oh, actually, and his own land. Those are the reports that Fergus is going to take and have certified in New Bern. So, did I say New Bern the first time?
Uh-huh.
Well, I mean, I did live there, so that's, it's hard. Oh, not even, I did live there, but sorry, I did not live in New Bern. I lived in Bern, Switzerland. So for a hot moment or seven.
So she was an old Bern.
I was an original Bern. Mm-hmm. But OG. And I speak German. Oh, gee, that's funny. I speak German. And so whenever I see it, I actually want to say Bern. But yeah, so they'd stock up. Their plan was to go down there. Fergus would go a little bit over to New Bern. And he would do the stuff for the surveys. And they would, while in Wilmington, they would stock up on supplies. They'd reconnoiter with Fergus, hopefully find Lion and Bonnet and get the stuff done, take care of Bonnet, and then head back to the ridge. So they go there, they get their work done, but there's no sign of Bonnet. No sign of Bonnet had been had for a few months. Meanwhile, they're stuck in a rented house that they're in due to a storm.
This is like their shopping spree.
Oh, gosh.
They're like, we're going to load up this wagon and do all this stuff. But before that, let's all get stir crazy in a cabin.
Joe B. writes, and this is regarding the house that they rented, which has very few, if any, windows. Quote, Joe B. writes, the window tax instituted in the late 1690s was a tax on glass. Any house with six or more windows was taxed, and it only ended in 1851. It is the origin of the phrase daylight robbery and why many buildings in the UK have bricked up windows or very small ones.
I feel like that came up in Pot Abroad.
Oh, but yeah,
Susan
always talks about it. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I'm glad, sir. I'm glad. I forgot to put that in the notes. You guys, we still have some spots available on Pod Abroad 2021. If you'd like, speaking of Pod Abroad, if you don't know what that is, it is our now semi-annual Outlander-themed tour, bespoke tour of Scotland. And you can find all the information at, should be able to get all the information at podabroad.com. So they eventually get outside and they go to the quay. They meet one of Roger's fellow seamen, Duff, from the Gloriana, from his days in the Gloriana. And he says something about a whale. And when he mentions the Gloriana, both Jamie and Bree visibly react. Jamie asks when Duff had last seen Bonnet. It had been a bit. And Duff asks them, are you here to see the whale? No, they weren't there to see the dead whale.
Oh my God. Shut up about the whale, man.
But now they are. Jamie was loving it. Of course, I'm being facetious here.
Facetious?
Yes. I think they take three boats because I don't think all those, the kids and the people would fit in one. But they have, I think it's three boats. So Jamie and Claire and Roger go in one of the boats together, the rowboats. And as they're getting down into the rowboats, Jamie hands his coat, which covers a pistol, to his wife. Cut to the chase. Bonnet. Duff doesn't know where he is, and he was last seen on Roanoke about 2 months ago. And we find out that Duff can't swim, so there's that. That's one way to threaten someone. And Duff also lets them know that Bonnet had been planning a big haul and handed it off to Butler. I don't know who Butler was, but it was someone. But Butler worked.
Can you spell that for me?
The way I wrote it was B-U-T-L-A-H.
So it's not just Butler and you're pronouncing it?
Not for funsies. I mean, it is fun. But no, I think I put it that way because I think that's how not Duff, but the other dude in the other rower dude. I think it's Peter. I could be wrong. Whoever that guy was, Diana transcribed the speech in some kind of accent, maybe Creole accent or something. So I just wrote down what Diana wrote. I think it's Butler.
I don't think Creole accents were a thing yet.
Well, Creole is not just one. Creole just means like a mixture. But this man was of undetermined.
I'm just saying they hadn't mixed a lot yet.
Well, this man was hecka mixed.
I'm going to have to look this chapter up again because I listened to Davina. So I don't remember her saying the name like that because that would have really stuck out.
So Butler works for Mr. Lion.
Sounds like you're saying butt love.
Oh, Summer. They will work with Bonnet, but they prefer not to. He is dangerous. So they end up rowing to the beach. Jamie tells the Roman, I'm making that up, but the men who row, oarsmen, to take Claire and Roger back when they're done. So basically hold here. It's like having a taxi wait, right? He has them wait. When they're done looking at the whale or whatever, take those two back. He says, none for me, thanks. I will swim back.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find it?
Okay, so I've got Duff.
Duff is the really talkative one.
And somebody's named Peter.
I said Peter, uh-huh.
I'm not seeing anything that says butt love.
Not Summer, I didn't say butt love.
You really did.
I said butler.
Nope.
It's near the end. Look for Roanoke, Duff can't swim, planning a big haul, hand off to, might be Butler. I don't make names up.
It's literally spelled B-U-T-L-A-H.
That's what I wrote, Butler.
But I feel like she didn't pronounce it like that, so it didn't stick out like it did when you said it. Because yours almost sounds like it's...
Butler. You said that. I know, we get it.
Butler, but also like you have a Brooklyn accent, like Butler. Yo, Butler. Because you deepen your voice a little bit, like you're like
make it more guttural.
Yeah.
Butler. Instead of
Butler. Butler.
Okay, that does sound like Butler.
See?
Joby writes, Roger is quoting from Psalm 107, and it is a prayer for safety on those in peril on the sea. And fresh from this peril, and with information on Bonnet, is a friend of Roger's. It must be a boon to Roger to not only be able to gain the information, but to have it come from one of his contacts rather than Jamie's. I've often wondered why so many sailors can't swim. And then in a very interesting podcast, Dan Snow's History Hit of 7th December 2019, Truth and Legend of the Age of Sail, two suggestions posited. Firstly, there was a lack of opportunity. The average lower-ranked sailor would not have had the opportunity to learn. And secondly, and terrifyingly, was the acceptance from all ranks, it seemed, that if a sailor went overboard, there was not the time to save him. Either because of the speed and effort to turn the ship around would leave him too far behind, or the time taken would affect the security of the cargo, in which case a quicker death was to be preferred.
And finishing off this week's read-along with chapter 101, Blink and You Miss It, Monsters and Heroes.
The kiddos were off to see the whale. Jamie is recovering on the beach. Roger chats with Duff further. They eventually let Duff go and all arrange for leaving. Once Marsali has gone to the lighthouse to go look for the octopus. The octopus is a ship. Now, Duff knew where Lion was. He's asked Duff. Jamie, I think, asked Duff to take a message to Lion. They're to meet at Wiley's Landing a week later, a week from that time. In their chat about the Duff discussion, Jamie says that captains have to be cruel at times. So they're talking about
Like, you know, what did you guys think of Bonnet?
Well, what was did the think conversation because Roger, he was asking him what Roger thought of him when he sailed with him. And Roger didn't immediately say what he thought. He said, well, everyone else, because he was like, well, how was he as a captain? And, you know, Roger was like, well, everyone kind of respected him, but, you know, me and a bunch of other people also were scared of him.
Butler.
You're a nut.
Can we talk about the fact that they were, okay, first of all, I think I've always been told that if you come across a dead animal and you don't know how or why it's dead, you don't
eat it.
Eat it.
Yep.
And there were people on this beach getting scoops of
flesh.
And Claire points out that he owns like a food restaurant on the street or in the main thoroughfare of town. And she's like, I'm making a note. We're not eating there tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't blame her. That's gross. But it's also, it wasn't just that he was finding food, but they were also finding food that was trying to eat the food, which was also dinner. Crabs. Crawfish? Is that what it was? Crabs and...
Maybe.
Crawfish. Anyway. I mean, I imagine this is like the movies of their time.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, how often does this happen? It's like Halley's Comet. I mean, it happens a lot more now because of, you know, global warming and we're awful people and, you know, we're killing the planet. But there was a time when this didn't happen all that often. Everyone was content that lived in the ocean was content to live in the ocean. And they rarely did this deal. So that must have been. And I mean, how else would you ever in that time ever see a whale other than when they're like cresting the water? Because like nobody had them in captivity. I mean, it's not like they could go to, you know, SeaWorld or an aquarium and see a big old whale. So, I mean, this had to be. It's no wonder those people were making money rowing people out there. They're like, come on, this is the day. Let's go get our boats. We're going to make tons of money trying to get people to get to this dead whale.
So Jamie's line where he says captains have to be cruel at times. What was Claire on about? Because as soon as he said that, she says, quote, you've never done other than you had to. There's a difference between cruelty and necessity, unquote. Was she referring to Alamance or Culloden or Dougal? Like, I was trying to figure out, why is she trying to make him feel better? What?
No, here's the thing. I think it's not just captains. I think it's just Lairds. Being in charge.
Yeah.
Being the person that everyone's dependent upon and, you know, being that guy is a rough place to be because you can't just let everyone do what they want all the time. There has to be somebody guiding and leading and being, you know, the leader of this group because you can't have 20 leaders. So if you have the one guy who's leading, it's a big responsibility. So you have to sometimes, you can't be everyone's friend. Sometimes you got to be the dick. So I think she was referring more to just his leadership role, period. And that was chapter 101. Join us next week when we will be continuing our The Fiery Cross read-along, starting with chapter 102, The Battle of Wiley's Landing. Continuing with 103, Among the Myrtles, 104, Sly as Foxes, and rounding the week off with 105, entitled A Thrush's Dreams. And y'all, there will only be two more episodes of read-alongs for this book because we are going to finish this book, not next week, but the week after. And as always, if you'd like to continue the conversation, please join us over on Facebook on our group at www.outlanderpod.com/group.
And a special thanks again to co-producer of episode 322, Marlo R. Remember, you too can become a co-producer as well as get all of our episodes ad-free by supporting us on Patreon. Find out more at outlanderpod.com/Patreon. And again, if you have any questions, you guys are always free. We welcome any questions, any emails. You can tweet at us, DM us, get in touch with us any way on social media you'd like. Email might be best because it's a lot easier to see that when it comes in quickly. But we are happy to answer any questions about the Pod Abroad 2021. And if you would like to join us or just read up about the trip, you can find out more at podabroad.com. So thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.
It's time to get organized this new year with Menards. Update your closet system and add style today with Closet Culture. Choose from two closet finishes and four colors of shelf boards to create a functional yet stylish closet solution that matches your home decor. Check out all our Closet Culture closet kits or view our weekly flyer on Menards.com to see all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.